Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking, well, maybe I'd like to call it a philosophical journey of practicality that I think you will enjoy. It should be able to empower you to understand how you can take more of a position of dominion in your life so that you can get the results that you want. We're going to be talking with Kimmerer L. Lamothe, and her book is What a Body Knows, Finding Wisdom in Desire. Kimmerer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Donna.
I have to ask you a personal question right off the bat.
All right.
How did you get the name Kimmerer? That is so unique. That's K-I-M-E-R-E-R. Was that a combination of names? I'm curious.
Actually, it was my great-grandmother's maiden name.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So she was Jessica Kimmerer, and I actually have cousins who have Kimmerer as a last name, and my parents had the bold idea of giving it to me as a first name.
Wow. Well, I just had to ask. Names fascinate me. As an author, I've done so many book signings, and I have people with these very unique names. I always have to ask for spellings.
Right,
because
right.
I never know. So I had to ask about your name, because I thought, I have never known a Kimmerer.
Right.
And I said, well, okay. Now, you are an author. You've won awards for your work. You enjoy being a philosopher. You're also a dancer, and you were the co-founder of Vital Arts, which is a center for arts and creativeness in upstate New York. Now,
yes.
You decided during your life process that you were going to study religion. You got a doctorate, in fact, in it from Harvard University. Then you taught at Brown and then at Harvard University. You received fellowships for your writing and your dancing from Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study and the Center for Study of World Religions. Now, that's a very interesting combination.
I call it a crooked path.
You call it a crooked path. Well,
yes.
As a dancer, one's supposed to be graceful. How is it that you got the graceful aspect of dancing mixed in with the crooked path of exploration?
Well, I found the path really began to take shape when I was in college, and I had two experiences. One in the study of religion that I was doing at college, the academic study, reading books. I read books that just blew my mind, made me think differently, see differently, ask questions about why humans are the way they are and what kind of ways we can create the world so that it will encourage them to be the best people they can be. And these questions were very important to me, these sort of big questions.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I had several experiences in which I discovered myself as a dancer. I discovered that in my own practice and experience of dance, which I was really beginning as a college student, I hadn't grown up dancing, I found these incredible moments of that I felt connected to some kind of power that was larger than myself, that I felt grounded in myself, that I felt able to open to sources of information about myself and about my world that I couldn't achieve any other way. And so because I had these two experiences, but they were in very different worlds, and as a result I started to ask questions in my study of religion about why isn't dance a larger part of our culture, and in particular the mainstream Christian traditions in which I was raised? Why isn't dance a part of these traditions? And so in some ways, I spent my years then sort of going into the dance world and studying dance and learning about dance, and then returning to the academy and looking at our traditions of philosophy and our values, our attitudes towards nature and women and the body, and trying to understand, why is it that we don't dance, and what would benefit us if we did?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, it's a fascinating area of thought, because in my mind's view, music, dance, movement is one of the most healing opportunities anyone can ever experience.
Yes.
Yet in so many cultures, it's there. I mean, you look at the South American culture, you look at the Native American culture, you look at the African culture, you look at many cultures that would have been considered quote unquote pagan cultures.
Yes.
And
yes.
The dancing and the movement and the release mechanism.
Yes.
Is just absolutely awesome.
Yes.
And somewhere along the line, somebody thought that it wasn't really a good thing to do. It was a bad thing. Well, you know, you never know why people get twangs in their mental
right.
programming. But they do. And it took, I think, in many different environments, it took the joy out of it. I know
yes.
that my grandmother belonged to a particular religious affiliation, and I'm not going to mention it, but it was considered a sin.
Right.
To, quote-unquote, to dance. This
right.
was awful. Now, it
right.
was okay for you to go into an altered state and babble, but it wasn't,
right.
you know, appropriate, and you could wiggle in that state, but
right.
you're not supposed to do the other because that's very, very bad. So,
right.
there, like I said, it's a twang in people's thinking, and
right.
this is my bias. I'm not going to impose it on anybody else, but I really think that, just like with children, I love to watch them when the music comes on and they just let it go and they don't
right.
care how they move. It's just, whoo, it just feels good.
Right.
And that is healthy.
Right.
Let's talk about for a moment because you, right off the bat in your book, address something that I think assails everybody one time or another. It's a very simple word, but it can be very oppressive, and that is the word stagnation.
Yes.
Give us your understanding of that word and how somebody can move their way out of it.
That's a good question. For me, it goes to the training that we get in our culture to think of ourselves as minds living in bodies. I call this our sort of mind over body way of thinking and feeling and acting. And it's a kind of education that happens so subtly that we don't even notice it. And happens at such a level that we just take it for granted that this is who I am. I am this thinking person that's living inside of this body, and I'm responsible for this body.
Mm-hmm.
I worry about this body. I need to take care of this body. I measure this body. I need to make it fit. I need to make sure it's healthy, and I need to do the right thing for it. It remains an it, a material object somehow that I'm inside. And I think what happens is that we develop this sense of being separated from ourselves. We don't just have bodies, but we are bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And our bodies are constantly moving. But we learn in our culture to make our bodies sit still. And it's in sitting still that we think we create value. It's in sitting still that we learn to think great thoughts. It's in sitting still that we learn to hold a pen or paper or work on a computer or generate the kind of products that will make us successful. And because our bodies sit still, our energy pools, and we can stagnate. We can feel feelings then. So our bodies will register this stillness that we're imposing upon them as pain. Pain, feelings of depression, feelings of dissatisfaction, feelings of frustration. Oftentimes, these feelings, sensations that we have in our body, are what the ways in which we are acting are producing in us.
You have four words that I thought were quite significant. Deny, distract, isolate, anesthetize.
Yes.
To me, those are habits.
Right.
And many times, and I can relate this to my own life.
Yeah.
The habits of deny, distract, isolate, anesthetize are often promoted as something very, very positive. But on the other hand, when you're a child, there are some things that you have to learn.
Yes.
But as an adult, we have to go through what I call the unlearning process.
Yeah.
So that we learn what we really are. And that sounds like a tremendous contradiction. But it's a part of life, and it's not good, it's not bad, it's just what it is.
Right. Yes, I think you there. Part of what I do when I talk about desire is I want to have people take another look at it and think about the ways in which they think about their own desires. Because just as we're taught to sort of still our bodies, we're also taught to control our desires, or that we're taught that that mind is supposed to be in charge of controlling the desire. And so we feel like we're going to get our satisfaction by controlling our desires. And what I want to suggest is that desires are movements inside of us, and it's information that's being given to us. And we don't want to either just do what our desires tell us or ignore them. But we want to open up a space inside of ourselves where we can gather and discern the information that they are communicating to us.
You have a little girl, or had a little girl. She's grown up, I'm sure, a little bit more since you wrote this book, Kyra.
Kira,
and,
yes.
Kira, excuse me. I apologize.
No problem.
And I love the story you had about her because you had moved to your farm.
Yes.
And she was only 4 years old, and she pops up with words of wisdom, and she says, "My mind is a world."
Yes.
And that is quite profound for a four-year-old. And she proceeds to tell you how she misses Boston, where you had lived previously. And she said, "Boston is in my mind, but there's a piece of the puzzle that's missing that's not attached to my mind, and that is me, myself. Myself
yeah.
is not in my mind. Myself is outside my mind." That's coming out of a four-year-old's mouth. That is really quite special, and she can't read or write yet.
Yes.
I love it. I just think
it's
great. I
was so surprised, yes. And I think she did, and she has, we've been trying to maintain it so she doesn't lose it, but that sense of being in one's body and is something that children do very much have. And part of what we want to make sure that our educational systems do is help them to learn how to use that energy, to work with that energy, to ride that energy, rather than to just repress it.
I agree, and there's a marvelous teacher in New York I interviewed last year that I thought was so intelligent because she incorporated dance in learning how to work with numbers, music and spelling,
right.
and, you know, it was
right.
terrific. And I thought, this is smart, because for some reason we have thought that kids aren't supposed to be active. You get a boy about 4 years of age to
yes,
nine,
exactly.
there's no way you're going to swear that they've got worms in every cell of their
right.
body and they're wiggling all over the place. But
right.
it's natural because
right.
that's a part of a child's expression. Now, do they need discipline? Yes. And
right.
they have to learn certain things. But this teacher uses it as a form and expression to be able to help vent some of that energy so then they can have the quiet times that they need to be able to learn and to be aware of different things. When
yes.
you were putting this book together, what originally spurred you to write it? Was it a big aha that, gee, I want people to know about this? Or was it something that came together over a period of years?
It did come together over a period of years. It had a lot to do with my work with a particular philosopher, actually, Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is an interesting guy. And he talks a lot about dance in his work, and it's one thing that people don't tend to notice when they or spend much time thinking about. And I did, as a dancer, of course. And one of the things that I was able to find in him is an argument that we have these values, and in particular we have these values that privilege our minds over our bodily selves. And those values, if we want to try to shift those values to move into what he would call a more life-affirming way of being, we can't just think new ideas. If we keep thinking new ideas, we're actually just perpetuating the problem because we're just trying to solve it in our brains without living differently.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this sentence where he says, what we need to do is we need to relearn the small things. And what I wanted to do in this book was to sort of take it right down. Where is it in our lives that we're actually perpetuating this kind of mind-over-body thinking without even realizing it? And so I wanted to take it right into our relationship to food. So I look at our desire for food. Right into our intimate relationships. So I look at our desire for sex. And right into our sense of sort of purpose and meaning in this life. And that's what I call our desire for spirit. So I wanted to figure out, how is it that in all these different realms of our life, we're sort of activating these habits that involve denying and isolating and anesthetizing our own desires? And what would happen if we actually developed the capacity through movement to feel our desires, to trust them, and to discern in them a wisdom that is guiding us to move in the ways that will bring us the health and well-being that we seek.
I would like for you to tell your story about cereal box logic.
Yes.
I love this. I thought this was so cool. You've got to share it.
Right. Oh, my goodness. It was one of those moments. It was an aha moment where you just all of a sudden see into this diet mentality that we have. The diet business, as we all know, is huge. It's everywhere. Everywhere we turn, we're being told that this particular diet is going to give us the health and fitness that we desire. And yet, there's these paradoxes within the message that we are being given. So on the one hand, we're being told, here, just take this schema, this schedule, this program, and just impose it upon yourself. Just do it. It's no problem. Just do it. And at the same time, we're being, this sort of appeal is being made to this eye, right? To this thinking eye that can just tell our bodies what, we can just tell our bodies what we want to eat. Now, if it were so easy to tell our bodies what to eat, we wouldn't really be having the problem in the first place. So there's this paradox here where we're being given something and being told, oh, this is easy. Just do this schedule. Just follow this schedule. Just eat these things and you'll be healthy. You'll lose weight. And yet at the same time, we're being told we actually can't do it ourselves. We need help to do it ourselves. We need to do it with these three steps. We need to do it with this particular program. We need to do it with this particular logic. And then the diet plans even go a step further in appealing to our sense of pleasure. If you want to see how any diet is advertised, you'll say, it will say something like, you know, you can eat anything you want of this kind of food. You can eat anything you want for this particular meal of the day. You can eat anything you want of this particular food group with the sense that you won't feel deprived, you won't lose pleasure. So here then is this cereal box logic that on the one hand, they're saying, oh, this is easy, just tell your body what to do. On the other hand, they're appealing to your desire for pleasure from food and acknowledging that actually that desire for pleasure is much more important, or at least much more powerful, or at least rivals in power our willpower and our ability to tell our bodies what to do.
Your children have really been some very good teachers for you, haven't they?
Yes, they have.
And with Kai, you were sitting, and the reason I brought that up is that I love the story about her, because
about
she's
Jessica.
Sitting. Yeah, she's sitting right at the kitchen table, and she's reading the cereal box.
Right.
And she's saying to you.
Yes.
Because she looks at it, and you said, right across the front of the box in blue were the words, lose 10 pounds. And she looked at you. She was very concerned. She said, will you lose 10 pounds if you eat that cereal?
That's right.
Now, you have to see this through the eyes of a child.
That's right.
She is taking this stuff literally.
That's
she's
right.
Looking at you and saying, this I don't think is good. Is this something you really want to do? And she's a little girl.
Right.
So she doesn't know that this is promotional advertising, or what I call mind programming.
Yes.
And it just what you said, that promotion is selling a way of thinking and feeling and acting
right
in relation to ourselves, but it's not really us.
Right.
And it takes a mindful presence and alertness, like your daughter exhibited.
Right.
And saying, gee whiz, is this the truth?
Right.
And then you went through the process of explaining what they were doing. You know,
And it's hard.
It's very hard.
Because we want to believe that it's so easy. You know, it also said, eat to lose on the cereal box. Eat to lose. And the two was a number two, and it was telling you how many meals you had to eat of this particular cereal each day. So here we had right embodied in this pun, right? Eat to lose. You can eat to lose. Oh, we want to believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's actually, you only have to eat, only two to lose.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
There's this tricking mechanism where we want to believe it's so easy. We want to believe it's just this temporary correction that we can corral our desire for food. And we pit ourselves against our bodies, against our desire for food. And we create a situation in which we can't win. Because we're on both sides of the equation.
That's true. You had a quote in here, which I thought was an interesting one, to sense that what is harmful is harmful, to be able to forbid oneself something harmful, is a sign of youth and vitality, the case of Wagner. Where was the case of Wagner?
It's another quote by Nietzsche.
Ah, okay.
Yes. And it's part of what I'm trying to get at in the work. I mean, part of also why we, if you look at sort of the discussions over obesity and the obesity epidemic, oftentimes our desire for food is blamed for the obesity epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
So that people think it's because we want to eat too much, we desire too much, you know, and that argument can be sort of played out in a number of different ways. And what I wanted to suggest is that actually our desire for food is one of our strongest resources, one of the strongest resources we have for guiding us to eat what's going to nourish us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's part of where I connect with Nietzsche in the sense that he felt that if you drop into your bodily self and you open up your sensory awareness and you allow yourself to feel your desires, which is scary, and we have all kinds of reasons that we don't want to do that. So you allow yourself to feel your desires, and you allow yourself to ask questions about them. You know, what is it you really want? What is it that's really going to give you the satisfaction you want? And to ask that question, you really have to push back a lot of the, what you call, mind programming that we get in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere we turn, we're told, you know, this particular bag of chips is going to make you happy. You know, this mm-hmm. particular, eating this chocolate cake is such a temptation. It's heavenly sensation, right? And so we're told that we're going to get these intense pleasures by eating this particular thing or by going on this diet and not eating this particular kind of thing. And actually, once we're taught that the food itself is going to give us pleasure, like the act of eating itself is going to give us pleasure. And so what I try to do is sort of unpack that and realize that, wow, you know, it may seem simple, but it's also really profound that, you know, our relationship to food, it's a rhythm. It's always emotional and physical, and we need to honor the rhythms. We need to move with the rhythms and find the pleasure in eating what we need and the pleasure in nourishing ourselves and the pleasure in following our own sense of enough.
Well, I think that when it comes to working with the part of self, to the discovery of who we really are and what really matters to us as individuals is quite a journey.
Yeah.
And I don't know of many young individuals in their teens, in their 20s, and in their 30s that really find it very easily.
Right.
And I don't say that to put that age bracket down, because I think that's a part of life where you are challenging yourself. You're often involved in getting married, having a family, or dealing with financial issues. There's so much that goes on. I think that often men and women, by the time they get into their middle to late 30s, begin to stop and ask, is this really what I want? What's
right.
wrong with me? Why am I not satisfied? Why is it that there's a part of me that maybe I would like to go mountain climbing, or I want to go and travel Europe, or I want to check out the Indian history, and I don't want to be frivolous, I want to be practical, I want to be hardworking. It's very difficult to understand the various desires that we have and not categorize them, not be
yes.
loose enough to go into them.
Right.
What would you say to someone that really wanted to get in touch with themselves?
Right.
And they're feeling uncomfortable because maybe if they do this, mom and dad won't like them. Maybe their husband, brother, spouse, friend will think that they're nuts.
Right.
I mean, they need to know it's okay. This is
right.
healthy. This is what we call growth. I mean,
right.
this is good. This isn't bad. What would you say to them?
Right. Well, first of all, I would want to emphasize that it is a practice, that it's a way of living, as opposed to a switch you turn on and off. And the one of the things I try to understand in our work is how everything we do in every moment of our life is opening and closing possibilities for us in that moment. And so many of the ways that we have of thinking, so many of our habits, our mind over body habits, are closing off possibilities that are there in our life for feeling and moving in direction, in certain directions. And so what we can do is realize that if every moment of our life is important in this way, by just making very subtle shifts slowly, we can start to open up a different experience of ourselves that enables us to honor the impulses that are arising in us. Now, in the book, I develop what I call the cycle of breaths, which is an example of the kind of practice that people can just begin very simply any day, any time, wherever they are, to just, and it's simple, but it's also profound because you move through four breaths which connect you to the elements and bring you right in to your bodily space and time. And just the very fact that you're moving through those four moments opens up a possibility for feeling yourself differently. So in the first breath, for example, you think about yourself as connected to the earth and you feel the earth supporting you. And you feel your body in a particular way. And then when you move into the air breath and you fill yourself with white light, your sensations change. And you realize, just by moving through this cycle of breath, that whatever orientation, however you orient your attention, is going to be shaping your experience in that moment, shaping your reality, shaping what you can know about yourself and in yourself. And so as you move through these cycle of breaths, and you really can do it anywhere, anytime, you create what I call this sort of space inside of yourself where you invite your feelings into that space and you allow them to unfold. You allow them to unfold so that you can begin to feel the discomfort. Because I feel that the discomfort that we feel in our lives, that discomfort is a potential for pleasure that has yet to unfold. That discomfort is a way in which we're communicating to ourselves, wait a minute, I know a better way. I want to move in a way that I don't feel this pain, and I know how to move in a way that I won't feel this pain. Now, if we don't learn to sort of trust that pain, if we try to, again, you know, deny it, anesthetize, ignore it, distract ourselves from it, make it go away. That's usually our first reaction. We just want to make it go away. But if we can learn to greet it, to welcome it really as a potential for pleasure that we have yet to unfold, then we can begin to make this shift and practice differently moment to moment in our lives.
I think also what it enables us to do if we've gone through grief or if we've had extreme disappointments,
yeah,
is to understand that those emotions, perhaps of anger, stress, if we can allow ourselves to make that okay, then yeah, we as individuals have a chance of having dominion. If we deny them and stuff them down inside of ourselves and make ourselves garbage dumps for this
right,
stuff, eventually, the stench is going to be so bad, it's going to have to be thrown up and out.
Right.
And it's not always in an easy way.
Right.
But I really think that it's a challenge to be able to acknowledge those emotions because
yes,
there's so much distortion, depending on what culture you're from. And I've seen this from people all over the world. It's not just the Western culture. I've seen it in Middle Eastern culture. I've seen it, you know, in African culture. I've seen it in various components. And it seems like it's a paradigm of the human condition. And
yes,
when you can be honorable with yourself, then you truly can be free as a person because then you will know your own truth, and that truth truly does set you free.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know we're just about out of time, Kimmerer.
Mm-hmm.
I want my audience to know about your website, whatabodyknows.com. That's whatabodyknows.com, finding wisdom in desire. And this relates to your emotional self. It relates to your physical self, your spiritual self, all of the different levels of you as an individual. She's done a very nice job of being able to present concepts and thoughts that maybe for you will help you open a door if you wish to take on that opportunity. Kimmerer, let me spell her first name, K-I-M-E-R-E-R-R, and Lamothe, L-A-M-O-T-H-E, and I may be mispronouncing that one.
Nope, that's perfect.
Terrific, Lamothe. So Kimmerer Lamothe, What a Body Knows, Finding Wisdom in Desire. Kimmerer, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you, Donna. I really enjoyed it.
This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away. Lots of good things coming.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's T-TAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717, TTAP.com.
Hello, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number, if you would like to call in and chat with me, the phone lines are now open. That toll-free number is 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, if you're a first-time listener to the show, all I need from you is your first name or your initial. That's all there is. And I just need that information from you, and then you just let me know where you're calling from also. I really like to know where you're calling from in the country or in the world. And then after that, I'll tell you my mental impressions, and you then will be given the opportunity to ask me a question about anyone or anything that you like. So again, 888-815-9756. A couple of points I'd like to bring up right away. First of all, if you've had a paranormal experience, and you would like to send it to me, I'd love to have you write it out and send it to me. I am building a file on the paranormal, and I would like to hear your story because I'm collecting 100 stories. So if you can get those to me, I'd really appreciate it. I'd like to know what it was that affected your life dramatically. Could be an out-of-the-body experience, a near-death experience, seeing a ghost, maybe having precognitive dreams. Whatever your experience has been, I'd love to hear from you. And what you do is send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at DelphiInternational.com. Or you can send it to me via snail mail to the Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. And then I'm putting this file together. Again, I'm collecting 100 stories, and I'd like to think that yours might be in there if you have one to share. So I look forward to hearing from you. Also, for those of you that are in the far north, in the wonderful state of Alaska, I'm going to be in Fairbanks from Monday through late Wednesday afternoon, and then I'll be flying into Anchorage and we'll be there through Sunday. I'm meeting with people privately, and if you would like to meet with me, give me a call at my office, 800-872-8852, because I am seeing people privately while I'm up there. Mother Earth is never still. She's always moving. The oceans that float on her vibrant essence of skin, if you will, the earth beneath those oceans is always moving as well. And I have in front of me some fascinating photos and information about how Vava'u, which is a group of islands, were birthing new islands. Now, many of us already know that the Hawaiian Islands are just absolutely amazing. There's all of this active volcanic activity that's going on, and it affects the ocean waters very strongly. And it's amazing to see how Mother Nature creates her new island masses. Now, this was in Brisbane, Australia, and this was during the year of 2006, and this gentleman started documenting what was happening right before his eyes, and the photography and his story is just amazing. He said they were near Niafu in the Vava'u group of islands in the northern part of Tonga on August 11th. They were sailing towards Fiji. He said there was no wind, so we were motoring along towards an offshore island called Late Island. Then they discovered that there were some things happening in the water as they were coasting through them, and what it was brown, gray streaks. And he said it looked like heavy oil that had been mixed with water. And then they began to notice that the water around this was sort of green. And he said it was very strange. And as they went further southwest, then they noticed something very unique. These bands of color became heavy bands of floating matter. And then the whole horizon became what looked like a solid line of desert. Now, they hadn't had any problems. He said it was just a very thin layer on the surface of the water. And he said, as we were going through the water, it sort of got pushed away by the low waves we were creating as we were going through it. And this was being created by the bow of the boat. However, he said, when they entered the solid field, it started to pile up and behaved like wet concrete. Now, to their amazement, he said it looked like rolling sand dunes on top of the ocean water as far as you could see. He said, we went from 7 knots of speed down to 1 knot, and pumice stones were right along the water line of the boat. Well, they decided they better turn around. They were getting into something that they didn't like at all, and they were going to end up being stranded, so that's what they did. Now, they headed back for the clear water they had originally come from, and once they got in the clear water, they decided they wanted to see what was going on, so they took a positioning in the clear water that offered them the opportunity to watch what was happening. They figured that there was a volcanic eruption going on somewhere that was very close. Now, they couldn't use their radio. They were too far from land to contact anybody. So their only options were either to sail south along the pumice rafts that they had driven into earlier, or to go back to the islands. So they decided, for safety's sake, that they were going to go back towards the island where they would dock their boat, check their boat out, and make sure it was perfectly sound and perfectly safe, and then they'd go back out to this strange floating sand dune, massive sand dune. Well, they went out early the next morning, and I've got the photo in front of me. Now, remember, this all started on August the 11th. On August the 12th, they encountered what they described as massive pumice rafts. And He said, we sailed along them until they were so broken up that we could safely steer through them. Now, they collected some of these pumice pieces, and some were as big as soccer balls. And he found the bigger they were, the more brittle they were. And eventually, as they were going through the water, when they hit them, they broke into very small pieces. But you know what they found? They found what looked like a cloud on the horizon wasn't a cloud, but actually a smokestack from the active volcano. There were two areas of volcanic activity in the area, and it's the Meta Shoal and the Home Reef, and the smoke was coming from the Home Reef area. Now, they were planning to sail south of these places, but they became extremely curious. They went back to the southern part of the Home Reef, and the photography that they have is just absolutely amazing. They said the closer we came to the island, the clearer the smoke stood out from the surrounding clouds, and every so often, a massive black pillar shot up towards the sky. And you could see all these particles coming down. Now, the wind was pushing the volcanic smoke to the northeast, so they felt it was safe enough to go in a bit closer. And as the sun was going down, they motored up to within 1.5 nautical miles of the island. And they put in the coordinates, noted everything, were keeping very, very good records. And this new island was smoldering with steam, and it was possible to get a good photo of it, which they did. Three mounds were creating a crater, with one side breaking off and opening up towards the sea. They said to them, from their positioning, it looked like a big island made of black coal. They reached over the side of the boat, put their hands in the water, and they said it was so warm. In fact, it was much warmer than it had been earlier. So they decided to sail away from this island before it got too dark, because they didn't know if they were going to run into more of what they call the floating pumice rafts. And do you know what? When they were leaving Fiji in the middle of September, they heard on the radio station in that area that pumice was drifting up on beaches in Fiji. And there was a scientist at NASA that said these islands will disappear with time as winds and wave action break them down. But what they found was that the island that they encountered still shows up clearly on satellite photos taken in the month of October following their being there. Fascinating stuff. But that's what goes on. And I'll tell you, I have a bias. I think that there is a lot of this global warming that has to do with volcanic activity. There have been major shifts in the Earth in millennia past where when a big volcano has erupted, cold weather follows. Dust storms create atmospheric and climatic change. So many things are going on underneath the ocean in the Earth's magma structure that so often it's ignored. So I think a lot of the temperatures changing in the waters are coming about because of the volcanic activity. Remember, there's that ring of fire. And we in the Northwest are very much aware of it. But that is something that can make a big difference. So when you hear all of these theories, keep in mind, there's a lot that goes on underneath the water that people aren't talking about. It's not just what is going above the ground. One volcano can do more damage than any batch of human beings could ever possibly do, even with all the nuclear power that we have. Again, that's a Donna bias. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break for just a moment. Don't forget, if you want to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Call me at 888-815-9756. Now, I do want to let you know that in the coming months and in my upcoming newsletters, I will be giving you information about areas that I'm going to be appearing in. There is going to be an appearance in Oregon, and there may be one in California and some other places. And as soon as I find out about them, I'll be passing that information along to you. And by the way, if you want to get my newsletter, go into my website. If you'd like to be on my mailing list, send me an email. I'll be happy to add you to the mailing list. I apologize for that newsletter going out a few days late, but you know what? When your computer hiccups and a computer system gets locked up, until you get it unlocked, you can't send anything out. Technology is a fascinating thing. I love it, but sometimes, very frustrating to deal with. Meanwhile, we're taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. By the way, I want to let you know what we've got coming up on the Donna Sebo Show. I so love doing this program. As you will hear me say periodically, I read 400 to 600 books a year. Why? Because I don't feel I can do a good job interviewing people if I don't know their material. So yes, I'm not a super speed reader, but I have my yellow highlighter and it's going a mile a minute whenever I am reading. But I have some wonderful, wonderful items coming up. Now, tomorrow we're going to be talking about being drunk with wonder. Steve Riles is going to be my guest. Have you ever known joy where it's just something that fills you from the tip of your tippy toes to the top of your head and you just feel like you are a beacon? You just walk along and people just say, ooh, I want some of what you've got because it just feels so good. Well, we're going to be talking about that and how you can be grateful and appreciative in life. Then next week, and by the way, next week these broadcasts will be coming live from the state of Alaska. We're going to be talking about fringe dwellers on the night shift. Now, this is going to be involving some tales of the paranormal, which I know you'll find interesting. Monica Holley is going to be my guest. And then on Tuesday of next week, we've got two guests that we're going to have. We're going to have Dr. Zoltan Rona. We're going to be talking about vitamin D. And then we're going to be talking with Sarah Taylor about becoming vegan in 30 days. Then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about the Diary of a Beverly Hills Matchmaker. Woo-hoo! Do you want to know about some of the special stories? Well, we're going to give you the real stuff. And remote viewing. Do you believe that you're capable of doing it? Well, Michael Ruiz has developed a training program, and we're going to be talking about that. It's called Remote Viewing Chronos. Then Dr. Robert Linden is going to be my guest. We're going to be talking about the rise and fall of the American medical empire. This book is dynamic. I can't tell you how significantly impressed I was with this physician who dared to vocalize that which he has experienced in his 30 years of being a family physician. I'm really looking forward to having him as a guest. And then, oh, we've got so much more that's going to be coming up. And if you want to know about the upcoming guest, go into BBS Radio, just like you've done, to get to the show and check out the show listing information because you'll find little short batches of detail about each day and each show and what it's going to be about. So that's a good way to keep up with it because we always like to help you understand a little bit about the guests that are upcoming. They're just amazing people from all walks of life, all levels of education and experience. And they have something to give you in the way of understanding and insightful information. So I do hope you'll make it a regular point to listen, because there's just so many good people out in this world. We need to know about them. If we don't take the time to spend time with good people, we're going to be mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and almost physically overrun with such a feeling of helplessness that, oh, we can't make a difference. I want you to know you do make a difference. It's very important. Let me share with you a story about a lady. I've got a photo of her in front of me, and I'll tell you, it speaks a million words of description that's very hard to adequately verbalize through the medium of radio, but let me see if I can give this to you. She's a lady who's of mature years. She's got snow-white hair that falls to her shoulders. She's got it pulled back behind her ears. She's wearing a purple corduroy jacket with jeans, and she's got sheepskin shoes on her feet, and she's seated on an old bench, and in her hands she's got old pipes, a tractor seat, a screen of wire that's been attached to an ugly-looking wood frame. It's all junk. Her story isn't junk, though. This lady went through a journey that I want to share with you. She said there was what she called it a dump. It was a pile of stuff behind her office. And she said she had been tossing things back there for a good period of time, especially after she had started a job at a particular dump in Idaho. And she said there were things that came into the dump that were too good or very interesting. She said, who wants to put them in a landfill? There was a wooden ladder with a loose step, a shovel, rusted pieces of metal, a shipping crate. And she said, my pile just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. She thought she was going to find a use for them someday. And she said, wow, she said she couldn't believe what she watched people tossing away. They didn't value it. Well, you know, there's the old saying, what's one person's junk is another person's gold. Well, she had a piece of wood. She had all kinds of things, and she just kept. She'd say, wow, that's nice. I like that. I don't know why, but I'm going to put it in this pile. If you've ever known a hoarder, you can imagine the unbelievable mess that was piling up very quickly. Now, this was a woman that was educated. She had had all kinds of jobs. She had been a supervisor with a major airline. She had worked at laundromats. She's been a house sitter. She's been a caregiver. You name it, just about all kinds of jobs that she had done. And she said she kept looking at different things because she wanted to feel good about herself. Now, she said her GPS system, and I really liked that, the GPS system. She called it her God positioning system. She said it just didn't feel like it was working very well. Have you ever had a day like that? Well, she had them all the time. And she said she ended up working at this city dump, and it was out in an area of country that was very nice. She'd hear the birds singing and just enjoyed itself, and nobody was really harassing her at all. And she decided one day that she was going to fiddle around with some saw blades. Now, they were all old and rusted. And she was playing around with a piece of wood. And a truck pulled in while she was fiddling around with this. And she said it was loaded with trash bags. And all of a sudden, she heard a ruckus. Now, it was around the bird feeders. And she said, okay. So she goes out and she says to the birds, all right, I'm going to have fix something up so there's enough for everybody. So she decided she was going to make a bird seeder out of some junk. By golly, it worked. She had all kinds of birds that started to come in. So she said she was going to do some better feeders. And I've got a picture of her with a fence and all of these unique feeders for birds. Believe it or not, some of them are made out of air conditioners, another out of a lamp. And she said, one, I took a license plate, put it over the roof of the feeder, and there were pieces of metal from a truck engine that went on a ladder side to make a feeder. And she said, I just stuck on whatever caught my fancy. She just kept going. Do you know, one day, a woman stopped by, and she said, the woman was driving a Mercedes. And she said, oh, my goodness, I've driven by here more than once. I want to know, is that piece that you have up on the fence for sale, will you take $400 for it? Well, what would you do? Smile and say, yeah, here, have the junk. I can, you know, $400, that's fine. But this woman said, you know, this is trash. She said, it's just trash. She said, well, it may have started out as trash, but you've turned it into art. Let me know if you change your mind. She handed this woman her business card, and she said, wow. So she is making feeders out of junk and smiling all the way to the bank. One person's junk can be someone else's gold, even with bird feeders. This is Donna Sebo. We are going to be having to say goodbye, and we'll be coming back tomorrow, same time, same place. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Enjoy this day. You've got so many blessings, you'll run out of time trying to figure out how many you've got. Count them all, because you deserve them, and even more. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.